Rewiring Your Life with Erica Spiegelman and Marcia Stone. Wellness, inspiration, support.
Welcome to Rewiring Your Life. My name is Erica Spiegelman, and my co-host Marcia Stone is not here today, but we have on a wonderful, interesting, and inspiring person today, Dr. Lewis Nelson. He is an MD and a professor and chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine and the chief of division of medical toxicology at Rutgers in New Jersey. He's also the senior consultant to the New Jersey Poison Information Education System. He is a board certified in emergency medicine, medical toxicology, human poisoning and overdoses is what he specializes in, and addiction medicine. Dr. Nelson also serves as a longstanding consultant to the CDC, the DHS, and the FDA on issues related to the opioid crisis and use and misuse. We all know about it, you know, too well at this point. And welcome to the show, Dr. Nelson. Lewis, we're happy to have you here with us. And can you tell us just a little bit about, you know, what you do, who you work with, and why you're passionate about this, you know, particular crisis that's going on?
Sure. Yeah. And thank you for having me. This is such an important topic. I really appreciate the time. So I am an emergency physician by training, and my specialty, you know, which really involved a lot of suicide attempts and substance use. And over time, I sort of got much more engaged with the problems related to, you know, substance use and drug overdose. And the problems sort of segued into issues with long-term care and addiction and managing patients who use substances, not just taking care of their overdoses. You know, the overdoses is a big part of the medical care for patients like this, but really preventing drug overdoses is more important. And the way we prevent drug overdoses is through managing the substance use. The other way we sort of prevent drug overdoses is to prevent people from using substances in the first place. So my areas of interest, areas of interest really stem from those two sides of the opioid crisis, which is try to prevent people from using substances and getting, you know, developing opioid use disorder, which a lot of it really did come from the improper or aggressive prescribing of opioids for pain management, and then sort of cleaning up the mess that we've made by looking at all these people who are, you know, they're dads and moms and brothers and sisters. And, you know, sometimes it's very hard to see past the drug use, but trying to take those folks and get them back into the mainstream and give them back to their families and back to their friends and back to their jobs. And so those two parts of my life became passion. That's how I got involved with these other organizations, you know, and I've always felt that the FDA and the CDC have missions that are, you know, very noble and very important. And we really need to help to maximize their effectiveness in order to help society and to help individual patients.
Right. Right. And that's why we need consultants like you that are in the kind of on the front lines and understand what's going on. Because, you know, for me, I'm an addiction specialist and a counselor. I have my drug and alcohol counseling license from UCLA in California here. And I've written a couple books on recovery, not so much not so much from a neuroscience point of view, but my book is titled Rewired, and it's really about rewiring our pathways through all these other principles we need to learn how to live by, like honesty and communication and, you know, healthy habits and self-care and all these things. But I do have, you know, day-to-day clients that are drug dependent and addicted. And, you know, I see it firsthand too, how devastating this can be. I lost a client a couple weeks ago, actually, from an overdose of fentanyl, but I think it was a suicide, you know, kind of attempt. And, you know, so it's just, there's so much going on now that has changed the landscape of drug addiction with fentanyl and, you know, the drugs aren't as safe out there. Sometimes, you know, I've heard clients getting things that they don't even know that they're getting, you know. So in terms of preventative, I've tried so many times, Lewis, to get to, you know, try to see if schools are open to having assemblies and education and even colleges. And it's very hard to get through the politics and just like, I don't know if it's red tape or what, how it is, but it's hard to get, you know, programs on the ground for these kids.
Well, you know, the country is more divided than it's ever been. But we've always had different perspectives on things. And, you know, there are folks who believe that education is the most important way to prevent problems. And certainly education is necessary, but probably not sufficient. But there are others who believe that by talking about something, you raise awareness of it and you cause people to do these things. So, you know, this is the big argument against, you know, against sex education, against
drug education.
Transgender
stuff,
It kind of normalizes it in people's minds. You say, well, they wouldn't be talking about drug use if it wasn't something I should be participating in, right? Or
you can say
the same about all the other things that we have to educate our kids about. When is the right time to start educating somebody about something? You don't want to do it too early. It won't be contextual. You don't want to do it too late because you've already lost a percentage of the people. And you know, one of the problems is, it may not be a one-size-fits-all, right? Some communities may need different things at different times. But clearly, education is very important. And it has to be done right. It has to be done well. I'm not saying I have all the right answers on how to do it. But we do have to be able to prevent substance use, because there's no question that treating substance use is not as good as preventing substance use, right? in the long term. So we have treatments. They're better than nothing, but they're certainly not as good as not having substance use disorder in the first place. It's a horrible disease, as I'm sure you and everybody that listens knows. It's devastating, not just to yourself, but it destroys family and friends and jobs and communities. And it's worse in some ways than dying. I mean, that's a pretty finite thing and life goes on, but this is just a continual stream of problems and you leave a wake of devastation as you progress. And we really have to be able to turn off the spigot of minting or creating more drug use.
Can you share a little bit, just for people listening, the highlights, kind of the origin of the opiate crisis and how it's changed over the past 25 years? And also right now, what is fentanyl and why is that dangerous for people that don't really understand?
Yeah, it's always a really important thing to understand. You know, understanding history really contextualizes where we are today. So if you go back to the mid-80s, there really was no such thing as chronic opioid use, right? And nobody would ever give patients, except maybe at the very end of life, more than a couple of days of an opioid. And some well-meaning pain docs at the time used opioids long-term for, you know, non-end-of-life pain, and showed that, quote-unquote, they worked. Now, the doses they used were fairly low, and the patients they chose were fairly safe, and they did a lot of monitoring, and it was just a handful of cases. But off of this case series sprung a whole specialty that really focused on the fact that pain is a big problem in the world, and we're not doing a very good job, or in the United States, I should say, we're not doing a very good job addressing it. And, you know, slowly but surely, this idea caught on that chronic pain is a problem. And chronic pain is a problem, I mean, unquestionably. The question, though, that was being addressed by these well-meaning, at the time, clinicians was that opioids are okay for that chronic pain. Before that, I hate to say it, was kind of a change your lifestyle, learn to live with it. And, you know, people changed a little, you know, some certain, you know, I hate to say it, but obesity got to be more of a problem. Sedentary lifestyles became more of a problem. You know, we started to have more patients with long-term chronic medical disorders leading to chronic pain syndromes. So chronic pain probably did advance from when I was young to where we are today. But so did the fact that we started giving patients pain medicine. And one of the problems with opioids, and with all pain meds, but by far more problem with opioids, is that we have a process in our body that adapts to the use of opioids. And it's called opioid-induced hyperalgesia. So what happens basically is, if you take a pain medicine and it suppresses your levels of pain, your body adapts and raises the levels of pain. Mm-hmm. That's hyperalgesia. The pain gets worse because you're on an opioid. It's the same thing as tolerance in a way. We always think about tolerance, which is I give you a little opioid for pain and your pain gets better. But if I do that for a few days, you need more opioid.
Right.
And if I do that for a few more days, you need more opioid. Well, we're saying in that context that the effect of the opioid is wearing off. Well, an alternative explanation for that that's just as valid is not that the opioid's wearing off, but that the pain is getting worse. So hyperalgesia and tolerance are really two sides of the same coin. One of them faults the opioid in a way, and the other one faults, quote unquote, the body. This is a normal adaptive response that we have. So in response to the increasing use of opioids, pharma, of course, created what at least made some sense at the time as being formulations to address the need to take pills 3, 4, 5 times a day and the fluctuating blood and brain levels that would occur every time you took and didn't take your drug, your medication. So it made sense, right? You have a peak of effect, and then a couple hours later, it falls down. You take another pill, it goes up again. So they created what at the time was a very mainstream idea, or they adapted it to opioids, which is creating extended release medications, which prevented the peaks and valleys from occurring. And it was being sold that by preventing the peaks and valleys, we're going to reduce the risk of addiction. Because the sense was that every time you take the drug and the blood level goes up and the brain level goes up, you feel good, you really like it. It falls down, you feel a little dejected and a little depressed. So you take it again and you feel good. Then you feel down, then you feel up. And they said that was what's prompting addiction and dependence. And dependence here meaning the fact that when you stop taking the medication, you develop a withdrawal syndrome, right? Dependence, not necessarily meaning addiction, two different things. Because some people use the word dependence to mean it. Addiction really means, at least in my world, that due to your procurement of drugs and your craving of drugs, you sort of ruin your life, right? It's this compulsive use despite harm. You lose your job, you lose your spouse, you lose your home, all because of your drug use. That, to me, is a nice wraparound definition of addiction. Dependence means when you stop taking the drug, you develop this withdrawal syndrome. So it turned out that these extended release pills, while they might have some benefits, carried a lot of risk or liability, which was you actually developed an increasing, not a reduced amount of dependence on the opioid.
Scary.
So those peaks and valleys turned out to not be a bad thing in some way. And the depth of dependence that people developed on these opioids in combination with the hyperalgesia they developed from this long-term, continuously positive, elevated blood level led to both worsening chronic pain and the inability to stop because they would start to withdraw. And they interpreted the withdrawal as worsening of their pain, as they should. I mean, it sort of makes sense. That led to, where we stand today when it comes to the addiction from chronic pain meds. Now, there's no question that some people abuse these medications to get high as well, right? But that's a different population of people who have chronic pain and developed addiction/dependence. Right, these are people who crushed the pills, snorted the pills, injected the pills, different population. But ultimately, the effect is really the same, right? You can't stop taking the medications. And, that's sort of where we were until they reformulated the OxyContin pill in 2010 to go from crushable to non-crushable to reduce the likelihood that somebody's going to crush it and snort it in the abuse model. But that does not have any benefit on the chronic pain patients taking the pill for quote-unquote therapeutic reasons, right? That was not a problem. They were not crushing and snorting the pills, but they still had addiction and dependence, right? So reforming the pill did have some potential benefit, but it carried, again, a certain downside. In 2010, when they reformulated it, what we started to see was some portion of the population change over to heroin.
And it turned out that around
the same time in 2010, the heroin formulations that we were getting in on the streets was increasingly pure and increasingly cheap. Right, so the purity went up, the cost went down, it became more available. So people who were spending a lot of money on pain meds were able to buy heroin relatively cheaply, and if you went and you started looking at that population, a lot of new heroin initiates, people who were switching to or starting heroin, were patients who were previously on opioids. Now, again, you can say that that was regulatory oversight, and by reformulating, we drove people to heroin. You can say it was a market force that raised the price of the opioid and pushed people over towards street heroin. So 2010. Till around 2013, it was really a heroin problem that we were facing. So, really it was an oxycodone, hydrocodone, hydromorphone problem from the mid-80s up until 2010. 2010, we started to see the heroin problems really come to the fore. I mean, we've always had a low-level heroin problem in the country, you know, 3,000, 4,000 deaths a year. And then we started to see those go up. And then in 2013, the world really changed again, where we started to see, in earnest, fentanyl and fentanyl derivatives appear on the scene.
They were like lollipops and little things at first. I remember seeing it. People would tell me about it, treatment centers that I worked at, you know, little patches,
The lollipops and patches actually had been used for a long time. The patches were used by pain patients because it was a transdermal, right? You just put a patch on and it would last for 3 days.
Yeah.
So again, it was even a more extended form. Remember, the OxyContin tablet you would take once or twice a day, the patch you'd put on once every 3 days, and it worked. If you define work as you get the drug into your body, then it worked. If you define work as it gets rid of the pain, not so much.
Right.
Once you develop tolerance and hyperalgesia, it stopped working, and people would need larger patches and more patches. The effect wore off.
Right.
Yeah, and the lollipops were often used for acute pain. Right. They you would put it in your cheek, and it would absorb transmucosally across the, you know, lining of your mouth. So those were really used therapeutically. Those were problematic, but not very problematic. Yeah, I mean, patches.
No, I just meant I started to hear about it. You know, I never had heard about it before until then. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But the fentanyl that we started to see on the street was non-pharmaceutical fentanyl. It was not made by pharma. It was made by labs, you know, in China, imported into this country either through regular channels, you know, through South and Central America, and sold as heroin on the street. And we started to see an increased risk of using heroin, right? Because the heroin, quote unquote, contained increasing both frequency and amount of fentanyl.
Yeah.
Right now, fentanyl is no different than heroin. It does exactly the same thing to you. It's no less safe or more safe when used at the quote unquote right dose.
Right.
The problem is it's much more potent, which means it takes fewer milligrams per kilogram to have an effect.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about it, you know, the amount of heroin it takes to get high is something you could see at the end of a tip of a spoon.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of fentanyl it takes to get high is smaller than a pinhead. It's almost invisible.
Wow.
So it's very easy to overdose on fentanyl because it's so hard to manipulate. And so the sales of heroin on the street that was laced, so to speak, or adulterated or contaminated with fentanyl became the problem. It became the problem. So the heroin supply, which was always unsafe because it was just made from some cartel in South or Central America, became even more unsafe because it now contained this very potent drug. Again, not because the drug was unsafe, but because the amount of the drug that was put into these preparations was unquantifiable.
Mm-hmm.
You have no idea how much is in there.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah.
It was no quality control.
Right.
So we started in 2013 to see a lot more fentanyl. And obviously, as that spread across the country, those numbers have gone up. And we now have what many call a fentanyl epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
Many have said we don't have an opioid epidemic, meaning, of course, fentanyl is an opioid, but they mean prescription opioid. But that is just not true. If you look at the data, there are still nearly just as many opioid overdoses as there were 10 and 20 years ago. But there are so many more fentanyl overdoses. When I say overdoses here, I mean death. And so we do have a fentanyl problem. We still have a prescription opioid problem. And what we're really seeing now that's making things even more complicated over the past few years is we've seen counterfeit pills, counterfeit OxyContins, counterfeit Percocets that contain fentanyl. So now you're not just buying powder on the street, but you're buying pills that look a lot like the pills you're used to seeing, but they contain fentanyl. Remember, the most visible consequence of that was Prince, right? Who died,
said,
from taking Vicodin, hydrocodone pills that actually contained fentanyl.
Wow. I didn't realize that. Yeah. I mean, I have, you know, young kids that are telling me, you know, that are in treatment now, but telling me that cocaine is cut with it. You know, it's really, there's really no, it sounds like a scary landscape for kids that are trying, you know, drugs right now. It's,
if you believe Mm-hmm. If you believe the story of the cadets down in Florida 2 or 3 weeks ago who bought some cocaine and wound up having opioid overdoses, you know, you never know what to believe with these stories. But if the story's true, we know that it's true. We know that when you analyze cocaine, a few percent of it has fentanyl in it. Just to be clear, in most parts of the country, certainly where I live, and I live in New Jersey or work in New Jersey, 97% of our heroin has fentanyl in it. I don't know what percentage of our cocaine does, but it's probably a few percent.
Right, which is unheard of before.
Different proportions.
Right, right, right.
It is unheard of before, right.
Yeah.
People would intentionally combine the two, yeah. Right? So a speedball classically is heroin and cocaine. And, you know, many, you know, celebrities and others have died of speedballs. I think John Candy did and a number of others where you combine the two. Remember, cocaine is a stimulant, heroin is a depressant. Together, they counteract one another. The problem is cocaine only lasts for 30 minutes, but heroin lasts for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So the cocaine wears off and you're left with a heroin overdose.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's so much. It's so much. And it's such a massive and multi-layered issue as well. You know, it must be just, your mind must spin around some days, you know? Right now, I mean, working with the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which is the CDC, and the FDA and, you know, all these government organizations, do they have like budgets for treatment actually, or do they have a plan to get people help? I mean, how, you know, for me working at treatment centers for the past 15 years, I see that, you know, people's insurance run out within a week. I mean, you can't really treat somebody with a, you know, 10-year opioid addiction in a week, you know? So, I mean, do they or the government or anybody that you're working with have any kind of new guidelines or anything that is going to be coming up to help people in terms of treatment?
You know, funding of treatment is tough. You know, the CDC doesn't fund treatment. CDC, you know, they create guidelines for opioid prescribing, and they, you know, help to think through some of the epidemiology of substance use, and they're very good with that data. The FDA approves drugs, but they don't fund treatment.
But they can't. They don't have a voice on this either. To like, you know, whoever.
I don't know that that's their job. I mean, SAMHSA is the drug, right. You know, governmental mm-hmm. drug agency,
right,
that's probably most interested in operationalizing, not necessarily researching, but making happen drug treatment. But they don't really fund drug treatment per se. That's usually funded through Medicaid dollars, or, you know, depending on, you know, commercial health insurance. Sometimes it's grant funded. Sometimes it's funded through, you know, religious and foundations and other organizations. But it is certainly a patchwork. But so is most healthcare, I hate to say it, in this country, is a bit of a patchwork of payers and who can afford to pay for these things. And, you know, sometimes people have nothing and they can't afford to get into treatment at all. But yeah, I mean, it
mm-hmm. So the CDC and all of that, they just make new guidelines, basically kind of helping us understand how, you know, recommended doses for certain opioids, and they kind of that's kind of their
yeah
role.
It's always been a good question as to how the CDC got involved with this. I think they picked up a bit of a blue ocean direction and said there's nobody really making guidelines for the management of pain, because it's not really a CDC. Mm-hmm. CDC has largely been an infectious disease and public health.
Right, disease, right.
Right, but they picked up the ball and ran with it. I think, you know, in full disclosure, I was on the original panel that developed the 2016 CDC opioid prescribing guidelines. So, you know, I remember when we were talking about that and, you know, how it sort of came to be. I was not involved with the origination of it. I don't work for the CDC, but they asked me to be part of the discussion, and it was an important discussion. And, you know, there are some really great things that came out of that guideline, and there were some problems. And I think the new guidelines that have come out are an attempt, to some extent misguided, but to some extent well done, to address some of the problems that occurred following the first 2016 guideline. But yeah, I mean, funding substance use treatment is complicated. You know, you brought up, I think, you know, some of the questions about these drug treatment programs that, you know, the funding only lasts for 6 weeks or 8 weeks. And, you know, why is that? I mean, nobody's gonna say you have diabetes, let's give you 6 weeks of insulin and call it a day. You know, if you have a chronic lifelong problem, you have to treat it. And then, you know, there are places that sort of do, they take advantage of some of these funding sources. And yeah, there's a fairly, you know, robust dark side to addiction treatment. And, you know, it's unfortunate. It gives addiction treatment a bad name. And, there's a lot of recidivist drug use. And I don't say that in a disparaging way, but, you know, people, it's a lifelong, yeah,
relapse.
And it happens. And it's, again, if you just compare it to diabetes or asthma or any other disease that we deal with, you can't tell an asthmatic, you had another asthma attack, I'm not going to give you albuterol to treat your asthma attack. You know, so we seem to do that with this disease because we feel still, despite all of the evidence we know about it, we still feel that it's a moral weakness and it's a human foible.
It's a stigma.
And,
right.
You know,
right.
The fact is that you don't know who will develop opioid use disorder after giving them a pain medicine, which is one of the reasons that we have to be so broad-minded about it. It's one of the reasons we have to be so directive about it with the prescribing guidelines, because what we know, and there's lots of data that shows us, probably 50 papers in the past 10 years, and maybe more, that have said, we know, we've studied patients who've had ankle injuries, hip surgery, brain surgery, biopsies, this and that, and we've given them opioids, and we know that about 6 to 8% of those people will develop long-term opioid use. Long-term opioid use, to some very large extent, encompasses addiction. So we know that about 6% of people who get started on opioid will develop long-term use. That's a lot of people. There's very few diseases that terminally obligate 6% of the people to a fatal outcome, you know, or to a devastatingly bad outcome like addiction, right? If every time somebody got their bunions fixed, they wound up having a 6% chance of dying, you know, and I say dying again in quotes because you functionally do die when you ruin your life. Many times people do die, and every time they just devastate their lives and the lives of everybody around them. But we know that 6% of people develop opioid use, and the problem is you can't predict who it's going to be. It could be the robust young athletic man. It could be the little old lady. It could be the priest or the rabbi. It could be anybody. There's nothing that prevents you from avoiding opioid use. It's not a moral weakness. It's just the way our brains work. You know, opioids do something to our brain that just makes it impossible to stop using them. And there's not, to our knowledge currently, any really good marker for that. So every time you take an opioid, you're rolling the dice. So the only way to reduce the risk of developing opioid use disorder, addiction, overdose, and death, is to use opioids as little as possible. Not to mean we shouldn't treat pain. Right. Yeah, right. But if people need them, they need them. Nobody's going to argue that you should, you know, if you have a bad injury, we should make the bar high and we should keep the risk low. And that's what I think the CDC guidelines.
Yeah. But, you know, but also, but people don't teach, you know, people don't, but there's not a class, there's not a course, there's nothing, like, people want the immediate fast relief. They don't really want to sit through acupuncture. They don't really want to try other self-care forms. I mean, I understand if you're in chronic pain where you can't move, you're excruciating, you know, it's ruining your life and negative consequences left and right. But if you have some mild pain, which I've had clients that said, you know, my pain wasn't terribly bad, but my doctor prescribed me an opioid, and that's how I got started, and that led to heroin, and that led to this, right? I mean, I've heard that story thousands of times through the years. But the point of this is, too, I think that where else are there other resources? Like, how can we manage pain without drugs? You know, is there other ways? Is there, you know, ways to treat the mind through meditation? Is there ways to treat the heart if it's something that's going on emotionally people take drugs for? You know, you don't even realize that everything's so connected. So I think it's just also exploring other avenues as well and having some kind of, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's there's not a lot of availability for these therapeutic, you know, avenues in the middle of the country, or people don't have access to therapy in general, or even therapists to see somebody and talk to, you know, so that's also overlooked. All these things are overlooked. Yeah.
Well, we spend a lot of time thinking about non-pharmaceutical pain management.
Interventions.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's everything from icing your ankle instead of taking a pill, to acupuncture and to therapy. But remember, when it comes to things more than ice on the ankle, somebody's got to pay for it. And many, many payers, many insurance companies won't pay for these things. It's much easier for them to pay for a pill at, you know, at $20 than to pay for a therapy session at $100. You know, or a massage or a physical therapy or whatever it might be. So the way insurance funds treatment has driven people towards the quick fix of the opioid prescription, which obviously has turned out to be a bad decision. We also don't want to discount non-opioid pharmacological therapies, right? Meaning ibuprofen, which is Motrin or Advil,
right,
or acetaminophen, which is Tylenol. I think people minimize the benefits of these drugs, but remember the goal of pain management is not to get your pain score down to zero. It's to make it it's to make it moderated enough so that you could function. And yeah, you might have to limp around for a few days, but your ankle pain is going to go away. And people with chronic pain, I got to tell you, my concern with chronic pain is that the threshold to start people on opioids is very low. They lead to opioid-induced hyperalgesia and all of the wraparounds that go along with that. And it doesn't really treat the pain. These patients still have terrible pain. So it's not like it's this silver bullet that everything just all of a sudden gets better. And on top of a terrible disease like chronic pain, you're adding a second terrible disease of addiction in many of them. Not all of them. And I'm not out here saying everybody with chronic pain who takes an opioid is addicted. But some percentage of them are. And we have to ask in the big picture, what is the appropriate risk we should be imparting on our community, and our population? Right? These are devastatingly bad diseases. And it's just not clear to me that we're doing the right thing by giving a lot of high-dose chronic opioid therapy when it's A, not working very well, and B, very risky.
Right, right. And a slippery slope at that, you know, like you said, it's hard to know. And as we know, addiction does not discriminate. There, you know, it could touch anybody, like you said, the athlete, the older lady, it doesn't matter where you're from, what color you are, what age you are, what you do for a living, it will devastate your life and can, you know, ruin your life. So we know
absolutely.
That. But yeah, so all we could do is, you know, to keep on, you know, addressing the stigma of addiction and, you know, try to have some preventative measures and, you know, education and, you know, just to get the word out there. So I'm so glad that you're with us today. We could go on and on about, you know, this topic, or I could go on and on because I've seen the evolution of it. I remember the pill mills in Florida. People, I had a client that would go drive down and buy, you know, 50 to 100 pills and sell them. You know, I've heard story after story after story after story, just in my position. And it's just, you know, it's just amazing. And I think it has changed for the better. And I'm just grateful that, you know, there is more awareness out there right now. And doctors and companies are being more responsible, and, you know, all of that has changed, I've seen, or I feel like it has, you know, so that's a good thing.
I agree. You know, the CDC guidelines, just to touch on that one topic quickly, if I can, the proposed revisions have sort of changed a little bit about what the recommendations were, at least to the publicly visible side. In other words, they've taken the 12 bullet points that were crafted in the first guideline in 2016, and they've sort of watered many of them down a little bit and made them a little bit less directive. Now, some would argue that less directive is better because we don't need people telling us how to practice medicine. Others, like me, would argue that less directive is a problem because it doesn't provide guidance for the majority of people who prescribe, who don't really think a lot about the downstream consequences. You have a patient in front of you. As a clinician, I could tell you, the most important person in the room when I'm taking care of somebody is the patient.
Yeah.
And I want to do everything for the patient to make sure they're okay. But I lose sometimes sight of the downstream consequences of what happens and of the public health implications of what happens, which is why the CDC's guidelines have not surprisingly, have a big public health perspective, right? So by changing the wording ever so slightly and taking out some words, some phrases that were directive, they've made these guidelines a little bit too, in my opinion, ineffective. There were some problems with the original guidelines, not necessarily because of the way the guidelines were written, but because of the way the guidelines were operationalized or interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So some people, for example, the recommendation was, you know, we shouldn't go above 90 MMEs, which are, you know, morphine milligram equivalents, when we start to titrate somebody up, what a lot of clinicians did was they said, well, you're at 200 MMEs, let me just titrate you down to 90 in a week. Mm-hmm, and you can't do that. It was clearly stated not to do that. Right. That's a problem. Yeah. They should have fixed that. Right. They tried to fix that. But at the same time, not any longer saying you shouldn't go above at 90 MMEs is a problem. Because I don't think people recognize that there is an inflection point for unintentional overdoses that occurs at about 90 MME, right? It actually occurs lower at about 50 MME. Now, what's interesting, if you go to the bullet points, it doesn't say 50 and 90 MME. But if you read the fine print, which, of course, most people don't read, it's still in there, right? It still says 50 and 90 are a problem. But for those who read the one-page, you know, assessment of the whole project, they're not going to be able to know that. And I think that's doing a disservice to the community, because while it's allowing people to make more decisions, I'm just concerned that decisions, as we've seen in the past, haven't necessarily been the optimal decisions. And that's sort of how we got to the place we were in the first place. So those were the concerns I think we have, that I have, that others have, with the CDC guidelines. There's a few places where they've changed some of the wording slightly, but you know, words matter, and slight changes in words can convey very different meanings. And I think that has happened. So I don't know what the final draft or the final version is going to look like. We're still in draft form, and I was not part of the redo of the guidelines, so I wasn't, you know, I wasn't at the table when they were being discussed. And I believe that, you know, there's a lot of advocacy groups out there on multiple sides pushing for changes to the guidelines, probably some to make them more stringent and some to liberalize them. But in my mind, they probably pushed a little too far to the other side.
Well, I mean, I'm so happy that you're a voice, and that you are someone out there that, you know, is helping everybody understand what we can do, what we should do, and also just to educate everybody on addiction medicine and toxicology and just, you know, addiction in general. So thank you so much for doing what you do. And thank you for being with us and sharing with our audience today about the opioid epidemic in general and just about addiction too. So thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, and thank you so much for having me. I do appreciate it.
But Louis, really quick, we want to ask you a really quick deep dive question we ask every guest before we're done with the show, and that is, if in one word, you know, what is your superpower?
My superpower. How about perspective?
Okay, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah, keep an open mind. Try to listen to what people have to say.
Yeah. I like perspective. Very good. Okay, great. And you want to tell everybody, you know, obviously they could find you if they wanted to ask you more questions or interview you themselves. Can you give us a little bit just where people could find you, Dr. Nelson?
Well, I have a Twitter, which I'm not religiously checking, but that's at L Nelson MD. You could find me on the Rutgers website. If you want to reach out to me, and certainly through Rutgers, the PR and other people, they can get in touch with me.
Yeah. And we'll have all your information up on our website and our podcast. So it'll be up on iTunes and all the other podcast channels, Radio MD. So thank you for being with us today. And to all of our listeners, until next time, be well.